This morning we are fortunate to have a longtime friend, Jimmy Creech, who I said I would tell him a little bit about his checkered career. He has a Methodist minister who ran into some problems with the Methodist hierarchy and was, I guess the term is defrocked is an acceptable explanation of what happened to him. But he has continued his ministry, and he'll tell you about that as we go along. But along the way, Jimmy worked for the North Carolina Council of Churches, did wonderful work there, peace and justice, and then went out to the, I call it the Midwest, where in the Midwest, had a church there, and I guess because he was willing to perform a gay union, he was again fell in trouble with the Methodist hierarchy, and I guess actually went through a kind of trial. And from our point of view, I guess he lost that trial and came back to Raleigh, and that's good for us that he's back in Raleigh and doing good work here, and not only here but traveling around the country. But I'm going to let him tell you about that. But it seemed appropriate to me. We are quite, I guess, proud might not be the right word, but we're pleased that we are opening an affirming congregation. But every now and then, I think we need to sort of take another look at that and see whether we're doing what we ought to be about, and also to find out what's going on in the rest of the country. And Jimmy keeps up with that better than anybody I know, and is in a position to share with us. And so, Jimmy, we welcome you and thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Good morning. It's a delight to be here. As I came into this room this morning, I felt a lot of memories of very many good things that have happened in this room and things that I have had the privilege of being a part of. And I'm just very grateful to be here. Back when I had to leave Fairmont United Methodist Church and suddenly was without income, you folks just sort of passed the hat and sent me a nice check to help me through. And I'll always remember your generosity, not only in the money that you sent to me, but the moral support that you gave to me for years and years. And I'm very grateful to you. I'm most grateful for your witness for social justice, for the true freedom and compassion for all people, the respect that you have for the dignity of everyone, and your willingness to be out front and leading the rest of the church and society in many, many ways on many issues. So it's a delight to be with you this morning. Cy gave me the daunting task of giving you an overview of what's happening regarding the true freedom of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in our country. A lot is happening, and I really won't give you in detail a whole lot, but what I'd like to do is give you some snapshots of some things that I think are very positive. First of all, I think it's very clear there will not be an amendment to the U.S. Constitution defining marriage as between one man and one woman because of the last election. I think the change in the Constitution, or the constituency of the Congress, moving from the Republican, which was dominated by the religious right, to the Democrats, that's pretty much a foregone conclusion now. There will not be a U.S. Or amendment to the Constitution any longer. That's something we don't have to worry about. There has been significant movement to provide marriage or to provide legal recognition of same-gender couples in the country. Of course, you are, I'm sure, aware of Vermont being the breakthrough state for the country with civil unions. Then marriage is now provided in Massachusetts. That is going to be challenged. We were hopeful at one point that it would not, but it will be challenged. There will be probably a referendum in Massachusetts in a couple of years to give all the voters there the opportunity to vote on whether marriage should be continually provided to same-gender couples. But we're hoping that by that time, the experience of the people in Massachusetts and around the country will make them feel that it is the right thing to do to continue to provide marriage to same-gender couples. New Jersey is the latest state to provide civil unions or civil marriage to same-gender couples. Connecticut provides it, and just recently Rhode Island, the Attorney General in Rhode Island just sort of announced that they will, that this, because of the Constitution, they will recognize marriages done in other states. They don't provide marriage in Rhode Island, but their Constitution is such that they will recognize marriages, same-gender couples, in wherever they happen to take place. So there has been some real movement there. We're thinking California is going to be the next state if the governor there doesn't veto the legislation that we think is going to be passed. And even if he does, it could possibly be overridden, I think, because I think the support there is very, very strong. What is, what I think, on the agenda for Congress is the ending of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. There's a good bit of support now, both in Congress to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell, to allow openly gay and lesbian bisexual people serve in the U.S. military. Polls across the country indicate a majority of U.S. citizens support that. So that's an important move, I think, that will be taken. ENDA, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, is something that has been sort of on the agenda for a number of years, and we're hopeful now with the Democratic majority and likely Democratic president coming in the next couple of years, that we'll be able finally to protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the workplace. Adding gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people to the hate crimes bill would also be a major step. So those are some of the national legislative things that are happening. But there has been, I think, a rather significant shift. The religious right has dominated the conversation for a long time, and sort of if you read the papers and listen to the politicians who are influenced by the religious right, I think it would be very easy to be discouraged, but there have been some major shifts. And a lot of times the shifting takes place on a level that's not noticeable. It's sort of hidden or invisible. But there are some indicators, and I think recently, in the last few months, there have been some very clear indicators that the shift is taking place toward really granting the full rights and privileges and protections guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, to all people. Sort of in the popular culture kind of thing. If you watch Grey's Anatomy or know anything about it, one of the characters is one of the actors is Isaiah Washington, and he said something called one of his co-actors who is gay a faggot, and it did so in a sort of private way on the set, but it became very public, and he was reprimanded, and he was required to do some rehabilitation, and that became a very important thing. I mean, it didn't sound like much, but it was not tolerated. It was not acceptable, to the point where he almost lost his job for doing that. Then John Amici, who was a professional basketball player, published his book about being gay and being a professional athlete. And Tim Hardaway, who was a professional basketball player, was being interviewed one morning by Florida sportscaster, on a, you know, on these morning shows where on the radio where you listen, people listen to going to work. And at the very end of the interview, the newscaster said, by the way, what do you think of John Amici being gay and coming out? And Tim Hardaway said, I hate gays. I just hate gays. Stay away from it, all this stuff. Well, the neatest thing that happened was the sportscaster was just shocked, and he said, Tim, that's wrong. That's hate. I mean, that's not acceptable. That's bigotry. This is a sports. I mean, he could have laughed, you know, about it. But he said, no, that's wrong. And this became a big story. And people all over the country, leaders in American sports, were very critical of Tim Hardaway. And he was supposed to be a spokesperson for the NBA All-Star game that was taking place, I think, in Seattle. And they said, nope, we don't want you. And a few days later, Tim Hardaway apologized and said he really didn't mean that, but still, it was an indicator that it's no longer acceptable. I'm sure you heard of Ann Coulter's comments about John Edwards. Major political Republican candidates for president said that's wrong, dismissed her on that. Her blog is now losing advertisers. They don't want to be associated with it. Some of the leading conservative people in the country have disassociated themselves from her, or at least said that she was wrong in making the comment. And most recently, in regard to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, General Peter Pace, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in a sort of rambling interview with that was published in the Chicago Tribune, was asked about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He said it should be kept in place. And he went on then to say he thinks that homosexuals are immoral people because they do immoral things. And that received a tremendous response. One of the things that happened was that the candidates running for president, for the nomination of president, were all asked, do you agree with this? John Edwards immediately said he was wrong, that he doesn't, that Pace is wrong, that homosexuals or gay people are not immoral people. Some of the other candidates were a little bit slow to come around to that. Hillary Clinton was reluctant to say anything to answer that question directly. Barack Obama didn't directly answer it. Yet, when they were pushed, they finally said, no, gay people are not immoral people. And they all supported rescinding Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Even the Republican candidates would not, except for a few. I think Brownback did say, yes, he agrees with General Pace. But most of them said they would not define gay people as immoral by definition. I think 10 years ago that would not have happened. All of these incidents of defining gay people, using language that is demeaning, allowing hate speech, defining gay people as immoral, that would have been, you know, okay, well, that's sort of reflective of the country, and it would have been fairly acceptable. But today, it's not. And I think that shows this shift, this ground shift that's taking place, that is going to be the basis. It's going to give us the opportunity to really help establish the full civil rights for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. It's an attitudinal change. It's not an institutional change. It's not a structural change. It's not a legal change. But it's an attitudinal change that I think is going to be permissive of some real important progress. In the corporate world, I think business has been way ahead of everybody in recognizing the full dignity and rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. There's been an ongoing fight between the American Family Association and Ford, because Ford advertises in gay publications and contributes to gay causes. You know, Ford has just had an awful year, been 2 years, several years. Their profits have been down. And the American Family Association has been calling for boycotts of Ford to try to force them to stop supporting gay causes and advertising in gay publications. Ford has been adamant that they will not stop supporting gay causes in advertising in gay publications. They recognize, first of all, that it's good for their business to do so. Certainly not an altruistic reason for them to continue. It is a business reason. But at the same time, I think that having taken that position, they are also pushing a real justice issue. They're really taking a stand. Other corporate businesses or other corporate entities have done very much the same thing. IBM is one of the leaders. Wachovia Bank has been very good. A number of national corporations have just been very, very strong. And again, that I think contributes to this this basis foundation upon which full civil rights can be realized. I'm now working with an organization called Faith in America. It's a national campaign to end religion-based bigotry. Faith in America is a name that was chosen by one of my colleagues because it has sort of a double meaning. It's about religion in America, and it's about having faith in the principles of American democracy. This is the brainchild of Mitchell Gold. Don't know if you know Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams. It's a furniture manufacturing company here in North Carolina based in Taylorsville. The company is about 20 years old. Mitchell and Bob were life partners, came to Taylorsville from New York 20 years ago, and started bought a small furniture company and began to make and sell furniture. Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams furniture is sold in Restoration Hardware, Crate and Barrel, Pottery Barn, Williams-Sonoma Home. Company also has about 15 what we call signature stores or showrooms around the country that are Mitchell Gold and Bob Williams showrooms. Mitchell in college was a history student, and he has been for a long time very clear in understanding the role that religion plays to justify discrimination against lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, and has, as a member of the board of the Human Rights Campaign and other organizations, tried to push these organizations to begin to challenge religion. But the secular organizations that really support the rights of gay people and work for the rights of gay people have been reluctant to take on religion. There's always been this attitude, you don't challenge somebody's religion. Everybody has a right to believe what they want to believe, and you don't question somebody's religion. So Mitchell decided he was going to do something on his own. And in the fall of 2005, he asked me if I would work with him to do this that nobody else wanted to do. And I agreed, because I really believe in his vision and what he wants to accomplish. So we created together Faith in America, and I'm the executive director. Mitchell is the founder and chair of the board, president of the board. We put together a very strong board and have really started doing some national campaigns in 2006 and are ready to start another major set of campaigns for this year, just simply trying to raise the money. We use media and marketing tools to educate folks about how religion is used to justify discrimination, how it's been used historically. The thing that Mitchell understands so clearly is that every major civil rights movement, every major movement to advance human freedom has been resisted by religion. Slavery was justified in the South by appeals to the Bible and to the claim that it was God's will and God's design. Women were denied the right to vote because the Bible said women should be subordinate and they shouldn't have authority over men. Religion or religious leaders used religious arguments to justify second-class citizenship. And in many ways, it was no citizenship because they were without the right to vote of women. Segregation was held in place by appeals to religion. So what we do is try to help people understand the larger history of religion-based bigotry, religion-based discrimination, and how that the use of religion today to justify denying full rights and protections to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people falls within that historical context. We used, I'll just pass these around. Let you look at them. It's better to see them up close. These are ads that we have developed, and we've changed some of these. These were early versions, but basically they're the same. These are ads that we've developed that we publish in newspapers, full-page newspapers. We publish these in newspapers, in the Afro-American newspapers in the D.C. area and Baltimore last year, working with the National Black Justice Coalition. We paid for the ads. They put their names on the ads. This one, let me make sure that this is the one that we published in Roll Call in the congressional newspaper. It says, "Offense Before God." It's a picture of Clarence Thomas and his wife, Virginia. Before 1967, laws would not allow Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, a black man, to marry his wife, Virginia, a white woman. Opponents of interracial marriage cited the Bible to justify this discrimination. In 2006, laws do not allow two men or two women to marry each other. Opponents of same-sex marriage cite the Bible to justify this discrimination. Using religion to justify discrimination is the real offense before God. In 1967, the Supreme Court ruled in Loving v. Virginia that laws against interracial marriage were unconstitutional. We wonder, if Clarence Thomas had been on the court in 1967, how would he have voted? This was in January of last year, during the Samuel Alito hearing. We wanted to get this into the discussion. We wonder, if Samuel Alito were on the court in 1967, how would he have voted? Today, America is faced with the challenge of how to treat a group of its citizens fairly. We've been down this road before. We can't allow powerful people to use religion to justify their bigotry. It wasn't right for African Americans, and it's not right for gays and lesbians. In America, the framers of our Constitution created a separation of church and state for a good reason, to protect minorities. Don't turn back the clock. Let's protect our Constitution. Religion-based bigotry, let's end it now and forever. So this is the kind of ad that we are developing to use in a variety of settings. I'll pass these around. Some of these are really designed to speak to evangelical Christians. Some of the theology in the ads is not theology that I personally, that speaks personally to me, but it speaks to a more evangelical Christian audience, and that's an audience we think that we need to directly approach. We worked with the National Black Justice Coalition both during the Samuel Alito hearings, and then in June of last year, we did a four-week campaign there using four different ads. We also worked with Jesus Metropolitan Community Church. I always want to get United in there somehow. In Indianapolis for a four-week campaign, and it was very significant. The congregation there did a lot of grassroots work, door-to-door canvassing. They developed T-shirts that they wore. Every Saturday they would go to the mall with T-shirts on that had the phrase, "Would Jesus Discriminate?" Put up billboards with "Would Jesus Discriminate?" all over town. We've also done campaigns in Hickory and Taylorsville, where the factory's located. Mitchell really, as an act of integrity, said, if I'm going to be doing this stuff all over the country, I really needed to do it where I live, and I need to let people know I'm doing this. So we started a campaign in Taylorsville and Hickory, and the local Baptist Association countered with a full-page ad referring to an anonymous citizen in the county who was funding this campaign and referring to me as the spokesperson of Satan as we were promoting homosexuality. So, in response to that, Mitchell writes a full-page, writes an open letter to the county, and we publish it with his picture and my picture. He explains why he's doing this. He talks about how, as a young person discovering his sexuality, that he was very suicidal, and how that, as a Jewish young person, he had Christian friends whose parents would not allow him to play with them because of their religious beliefs, and so how he experienced religion-based bigotry as a child and as a young man, and finally had to come to terms with it and accept himself, and he doesn't want that to happen to others today. So that is part of his reason, his own personal commitment. So this was in the paper. So Taylorsville paper is a weekly, so we get to see what they do, and then we do something next. So we had this ongoing thing to the point where the local Baptist Association decided they would have a countywide revival and invite a former homosexual minister to come and speak. I don't know if you know Tim Wilkinson. He's located in Wake Forest here, and he has a ministry to help congregations reach out to homosexuals, welcome them in, and then begin the process of helping them overcome their homosexuality. He was the speaker, and it was held at the local high school, which was one major high school, consolidated school in the county. There were 1,200 people in the auditorium, plus the cafeteria was overflowing, holding the overflow. Mitchell and I went, and they were expecting us and had saved seats on the front row for us. So we went down and sat in the front row. The minister said some very insignificant things. He said, first of all, nobody chooses to be homosexual, which I think for most people in that room was news to them. Choice has always been a big thing for evangelical Christians, believing that homosexuality is something you choose to do. He said, it's something that you are born with. He went on to say, the evangelical Christians need to ask the forgiveness of the homosexual community. That was his language. Because of the way we have treated them. That was another important point that he made. He then went on to say that, same-sex sexual relationships are sinful and you can overcome them by giving your soul to Jesus, letting Jesus be your Lord and Savior, and you can overcome the temptation. He really tried to talk about sexual orientation as a temptation that's born within you that needs to be overcome. And so he was very careful to have pictures all around of his wife and three children to prove that he had overcome his homosexuality. We actually went out to dinner with him afterwards, and a couple of his supporters had a very good conversation. So what happened is we started a conversation with evangelical Christians who really are, strongly opposed to homosexuality, but began to break down some of the barriers, and that was that's part of what we were trying to do, is to have this kind of conversation going on. We also did a campaign in Colorado Springs. If you're familiar with Colorado Springs, that's the home base of James Dobson and was the home base of Ted Haggard before his being exposed and his leaving the area. Very conservative area. What we did there was a direct mail campaign. We had four letters composed, and we sent a letter each week to 16,000 residents of Colorado Springs, and we were able to identify 16,000 evangelical Christians in Colorado Springs, which wasn't really hard. You could probably close your eyes and throw the mail out there, and you'd hit 16,000. But anyway, the first letter was composed by my colleague, Brent Childress, who is an evangelical Christian. He actually attends a Pentecostal church right now because his pastor would not, his pastor of the Baptist church that he was attending would not celebrate his marriage because he was marrying for the second time after a divorce. So he's gone to a Pentecostal church now. Brent is the mastermind behind the ads. He's designed the ads. Brent wrote a letter about how, as an evangelical Christian, he, who once was very anti-gay, how he has changed his mind and his heart, and how he now welcomes and affirms gay people. The second letter was written by a lesbian woman, a lesbian minister in Colorado Springs, talking about the pain that she has experienced and her friends have experienced from religion. A third letter was written by nine clergy in Colorado Springs that are open and welcoming to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people, talking about their journey and welcoming people to come and talk to them. And the fourth letter was written by me about the history of religion-based bigotry. We sent those letters one a week for 4 weeks, did polling beforehand and polling after. When there was some positive shift in attitudes, we actually started sending the letters out just after Ted Haggard was exposed, so we think that may have had some impact on things. But that's what I'm working on right now. We're going to be going to Ames, Iowa, Reno, Nevada, Manchester, New Hampshire, Greenville, South Carolina. All, of course, are in the heart. These cities are in the heart of primary states. We were wanting to push this issue for presidential candidates, those seeking the nomination of their parties, so that folks will have to talk about this. We'll also go back to Colorado Springs for a follow-up campaign there this year. We've met with Hillary Clinton. We've met with Nancy Pelosi to talk about what we're doing and the need to challenge the use of religion to justify legislation that does harm to gay people. They're very supportive. We've met with Barack Obama's office. They're supportive to, we haven't met with Barack Obama, but we have met with some of his staff. Very supportive, but not willing to make a commitment at this point. Hillary Clinton did, and Nancy Pelosi did. We're also developing a campaign around the 40th anniversary of the Loving versus Virginia decision, which is June 12th of this year, about marriage equality. Yes?
What kind of commitment did they make?
Just simply saying that this needs to be, that religion-based bigotry does need to be challenged, that we can no longer allow the right-wing Christian community, religious community, to control Congress. No commitments on marriage, no commitment on any particular legislation, only that the message is the message that needs to be addressed. One thing I'd like to share, I don't know how many of you know Mel White. Mel White was a ghostwriter for Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, wrote Jerry Falwell's autobiography. worked with Billy Graham and a number of the leaders in the evangelical movement, came out several years ago, finally coming to terms with his being gay, came out as a gay man, and all of his former friends deserted him, wouldn't have anything to do with him. And he's really, he founded Soul Force, which is an organization using the nonviolent principles of nonviolent resistance to challenge religious institutions and the harm they do to gay people. His book was just published recently. I'll pass it around. It's called Religion Gone Bad. It's a wonderful history about how the religious right has taken control in this country. A number of very good books have come out recently about this, which I think is another indicator of some shifting going on in our culture. I don't think I have quite enough of these for everyone, but you can pass them and take them if you like. It tells about what we're doing. Now, I haven't left a great deal of time for questions, but I'd like to entertain them. Yes?
I have a question. I think that religious rights, the evangelicals, are still very pivotal in elections.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they will continue to be. I don't want to create any impression that we don't need to work hard, particularly on the state level. I mean, we had 2 weeks ago a major rally here, two or three, I don't know how many thousand of 5,000, yeah, of Christian folks, so-called Christian folks, warning to have a North Carolina constitutional amendment. So the religious right is not going away. They haven't folded. They're going to continue to push hard and resist. And I think, especially on the state level, we've got a lot to do. We do have an organization called the North Carolina Religious Coalition for Marriage Equality, and working very hard to prevent a constitutional amendment in this state. Also, with the hope down the road to provide marriage equality to all couples. But there's a lot still that needs to be done, and I think all of the books that are coming out now should help folks have a better frame of reference and understanding about the need to challenge the religious right. Another question? Yes?
You mentioned that there is legislation being considered to prevent discrimination in the workplace.
Yes. Well, of course, in this state, you can be fired for any reason or no reason at all because it's a right-to-work state. But in other states where there are protections, sexual orientation is not included in the list of protected classes, such as race, religion, women, or gender, ethnicity. They're not protected. So that if someone were fired because they were gay, they were not be protected. It's widespread. It's widespread.
Okay.
Yeah, very few states, very few states have that protection, and so a national legislation to include sexual orientation is necessary.
Do you personally know a lot of gays that have been discriminated in the workplace?
I don't know a lot. I personally know, but it's just a protection that is required. Yes.
I know one in particular.
Okay. Was that in North Carolina?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Do you feel that this anti-gay movement is more prevalent among blacks And if so, why?
It's a very interesting question. I'm reading right now a book by Horace Griffin, who is an African-American pastor, called Their Own Receive Them Not, African-American Lesbian and Gays in the Black Church. There's a good bit been written, a good bit that has been written on that. A lot of it has to do with the Christianization of Africans in this country was primarily from Baptist and Methodist groups that were very conservative and very evangelical. One of the ways that racism plays out in this country is to look at African Americans as over sexualized, that women, African American women, were over sexed, and that African American men were aggressive toward white women sexually. And so one of the ways that the black community has sort of internalized that racism is to become, in many ways, very conservative in regard to sexual ethics. And homosexuality was one of the things that they did not want to associate with. For one thing, racism in the country, in this country, and probably all over the world, questioned the manhood of African American males, and for African American male to identify as gay would sort of reinforce that perception, or that the African American males are weak. A number of other things, but it's an interplay of racism, of internalized racism, and very conservative Christian influence in the very beginnings. The same is true in Africa. The missionaries that went to Africa primarily were from very conservative Christian theological perspectives, and so homosexuality is not at all among Christians in Africa, black Africans, accepted and welcome and affirmed or recognized even. So it's a complicated question. There is, within the African American community in this country, a real growing and organized effort to counter that. We sat down before we ran any of these ads with Al Sharpton and showed these ads to him, and he thought they were great. Chuck Stone, you know Chuck Stone, saw these ads. He thought they were brilliant. We have on our board Rodney Powell, who was one of the leaders of the boycotts in Nashville in the early 60s, and one of the early civil rights leaders. He's one of the children that David Halberstam writes about in his book, The Children. And he's gay. He didn't come out until much later in life. But he's on our board, and Irene Monroe, who is a African-American lesbian, is on our board working with us on this. They're helping us to understand this interplay of racism and heterosexism and how it plays out in the black church. Other questions? Yes, sir.
I've seen a couple of recent articles suggesting that the very fundamentalist, conservative, right-wing church movement, while they're not changing their positions on issues like homosexuality and abortions and so forth, that they're shifting their priorities and that they're shifting it more toward poverty issues and away from some of these other more inflammatory issues. Any comments on that?
Well, I think essentially what they're doing is going back to their roots, because I think in the early 1900s, evangelical Christians were a part of some of the important social justice movements in this country. The evangelical Christians who are really focusing on poverty and even AIDS in Africa, a larger scope of social justice issues, really haven't been comfortable in the fundamentalist camp. And the fundamentalists have really taken over the religious right and the evangelical Christian movement. And so I think it's sort of a natural thing that has happened, that they are beginning to pull out and beginning to focus on other things. Mitchell and I are trying to meet with Rick Warren, who is the head of one of the major evangelical groups in America, one of the key leaders, who is among those who sees God calling people to love their neighbor, to do justice, to take care of the needy. And we're hoping that we can begin a dialogue with him and some others, like the ones you're referring to help them see the harm that has been done here. And one of the things, well, I led two focus groups in Charlotte a couple of weeks ago. One group identified themselves as accepting of gay people, and the other group identified themselves as not accepting of gay people, both groups of Christians. And the thing that was clear that separated the groups is that those who were accepting knew gay people. Those who were not accepting did not know gay people.
As far as
they know. They don't know anybody who's gay. Well, there's a big difference. I mean, you know, it's until someone identifies, they're invisible as a gay person. And so, from the second group's perspective, they didn't know anybody. And what we want to do is help begin to make those connections, and really put a human face on the people that are being harmed by evangelical Christians. You may have heard recently that the head of the Southern Baptist, is it South? It's in Tennessee. One of the leading Southern Baptist theological schools. The head of the school said that if it's proven that homosexuality is has a genetic base, that he would support using hormones or some kind of genetic manipulation if it can be discovered. You know, the embryo or the fetus can be determined to be gay, that he would support using some kind of intervention to prevent that from happening. In many ways, that's horrendous. I mean, it's just awful. But on the other hand, it's a gift. I mean, reasonable people are going to hear that and say, how extreme are we? Are we going back to, what Nazi Germany did and all the experiments they did with biology? I think there are many evangelical Christians that are just going to be turned off by that, and also the real rabid right-wing fundamentalist kinds of things that are happening. I think there is going to be a shift among evangelical Christians. One of the language problems we have is referring to evangelical Christians as the bad guys. They're not all bad guys. maybe. But, you know, there is a very strong tradition within the evangelical Christian movement of loving the neighbor and doing justice. And we, I think, need to help them get back to that by being in dialogue with them. Other questions? Yes?
First of all, I mean, this is great. Your ads, you know, as I look at them, are provocative. Is that intentional?
Absolutely. we showed these to the Human Rights Campaign, and do you know the Human Rights Campaign? It's sort of the major advocate for the rights, civil rights of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people in the country. It's a secular group. It doesn't have any religious focus at all. It does now because Mitchell encouraged it to, and that program's just a year old. But it hadn't for a long time. We showed these ads to them. They said, "Oh no, this is, you know, these are too provocative. We want to be provocative. We really want people to see these and to wake up." Mitchell said that there, for a number of years, their advertising was very sort of middle of the road, you know, unprovocative. And then they put a naked man on a couch with a pillow over him, and their cells shot up. So being provocative is very helpful. You know, you get attention, people respond. So we won't put any naked people in our ass, but we will try to be provocative.
A clarifying question for me: Faith in America, is it a Christian organization? Because seems that most of the stuff you're referring to are Christian things.
We recognize that the Christian religion in this country is the primary obstacle to overcome, mm-hmm. and so our messages are directed in that way. We are not promoting religion. We do not have a theological point of view.
Okay.
It's with my colleague Brent. That's hard because he is an evangelical Christian, and he keeps warning us to say things theologically. But what we are trying to do is to show the historical context of how religion has been misused in this country. Other questions? Yes. 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 I don't really see the United Methodist Church making any progress anytime soon. I think the conservatives have a very strong hold on it. Now, there are pockets of very progressive United Methodists around the country on the what we call the Western jurisdiction, which is the West Coast, part of New England, or the Northeast, or the Chicago area. But most Methodists, I mean, one of the things to say about that is that's where you find the least Methodists, the fewest number. Where you have the largest number of Methodists is in the Southeast, in the Central, and in the Midwest, in the central part of the country. And that's very conservative. And the fundamentalists have gained control, and they're not going to let it go. So, denominations, progress in denominations is going to be much slower than I think in the larger society. United Church of Christ, of course, is leading the way as a denomination, and I'm very grateful for that. But I was with Emily Eastwood just recently. She's the head of the United Church of Christ Coalition for Lesbian and Gay Ministries, and I'm aware by conversations with her and just following the news that you still have a struggle within your denomination.
Absolutely.
So,
I mean, it's exactly as you said, it's on a congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Like congregation.
In North Carolina is one of the
best. Yes, yes.
Jimmy, I believe the Eastern Association of the Methodists withdrew its support from the Council of Churches when they took in the Metropolitan Church, but I think they've now restored that.
That's correct, yes. That was an embarrassment to many United Methodists in eastern North Carolina, but they could never get the votes to reverse that decision. My understanding is one afternoon, just without any plan, somebody stood and moved that decision be rescinded. And many of the opponents just didn't happen to be in the room that day. And so it passed. That's right. It passed. And because it was such an embarrassment to begin with, they've never been able to get it back on the floor to cut off funds again. So that was a wonderful happenstance, yes. Did you have your hand up, sir? Okay. Yes. We are not working specifically with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I mean, there's been legislation introduced, and there's a good bit of support for it right now. What we have done is we did a press release challenging General Pace's claim that homosexuality is immoral, and that he justifies his belief because of his upbringing, which we think clearly was his religious training or teachings. And we're saying, you know, in our press releases, it is not right to use your religious beliefs to define someone else as immoral, and to do that in a public way that has public policy implications. So we're challenging the religion-based bigotry that is behind his statement. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that you do work in Colorado Springs, and it's pretty well known now that the leadership of the Air Force Academy is pretty much fundamental to Christian, and they've discriminated against people.
Yes.
Cadets in the academy.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had to deal with that at all? Have you dealt with that issue?
And our work there has been limited to doing some grassroots organizing within the community to identify folks who are supportive of what we're doing and to sort of develop a base there of support, and then to send out these letters. We will be going back probably in the fall to do some to use the media approach. We may be engaged at that point with the Air Force Academy. We'll just simply have to see. But that's been a major scandal, really. Yes, ma'am.
Could you comment on the effect of the openly gay Episcopalian bishop?
Yes. Gene Robinson is an extraordinary man. I think his being elected and consecrated as a bishop in the Episcopal Church was one of the major breakthroughs. It may result in the Episcopal Church in America being separated from the Anglican Communion. And that in itself will be a loss, but it will also be, at the same time, a major witness for the integrity of the gospel and the integrity of the church. I think it was one of the important gifts to the movement. When he was elected and consecrated. Yes?
I'm guessing in your work you probably are more specific than this, but for us to say that, well, to use our own morality to define somebody else's behavior as immoral is wrong, well, I mean, I do that every day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I use my own sense of morality and Christian ethics to define, say, the war making in Iraq as wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm guessing you probably define a little bit more, say a little bit more specifically than that. How do you do that? How do you do that?
Well, first of all, homosexuality as a category of immorality is wrong. Simply said, it's not taking into account the loving relationship between people. It doesn't take into account that the specific acts that homosexuals are understood to perform are performed between men and women just as well as between two men or between two women. It's all based. This whole thing is a thing of bigotry. It's not really a rational. Understanding of ethics and what makes things right and wrong. It's just categorically saying, you know, a group of people who identify as homosexuals or who are identified as homosexuals are immoral. It's in the same way that as a young person growing up in Eastern North Carolina, I was taught that that colored people are morally inferior to white people, and it was a teaching of bigotry and not of reason.
So it's more like you're saying that for me to use for any of us to use our morality, to our sense of morality, our upbringing, to define another category of people as immoral or class of people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you simply have to look at it, at what's, you know, what you're doing. I don't want to make any categorical statements like that.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying
they just don't have the facts right.
Well,
and,
it's
and the thing that you're talking about, like if you say you're against the war, you got some facts to back up why you're against the war.
It's sort of a knee-jerk response to a group of people saying, okay, of course homosexuals are immoral, just by definition, without any deeper thinking than that, just categorically. Yes, there are some gay people who are immoral and do immoral things, but it's not because they're gay, and it's not because they are loving, and it's not because they're sexual. And just as there are non-gay people who are immoral. But to classify a whole group of people as immoral is an act of bigotry. Yeah.
Isn't it about abridging their civil rights as well?
Well, it becomes that when that attitude is translated into public policy, into law. Yeah. It's how religion is used to justify legalized discrimination.
Jimmy, I wonder if you could do a little local history here. There was an organization here, Ringley, which a member of this congregation, Nancy Keppel, was very instrumental in starting. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
And I, you know, those of you who don't know Nancy Keppel, she did probably as much as anybody in this community to bring about equality. For people serving on the Raleigh Human Relations Council and so forth. But Ringley was sort of her creation, and you and Hugh Lewis and Father Charlie Mulholland were all instrumental in making that go in this area.
I'll try to do that really quickly. In 1987, I came to Raleigh and was standing outside of Congressman Price's office protesting the war in Nicaragua and the U.S. support of it. And I was standing next to a short woman with a sign, and she introduced herself to me, and she was Nancy Keppel. And she said, and I had just come to Raleigh to be pastor at Fairmont, and she said, we're getting some pastors together, some clergy together, to talk about gay issues. Are you interested? And I said, yes. And the next thing I know, I'm sitting in the library here with Nancy Keppel, Dave Barber, Callie Rogers Whitty, and a few other clergy talking about how the environment in Raleigh was so hostile to gay people and the need to counter that with a very strong voice from the religious community of acceptance and welcome to gay people. And out of that meeting came the Raleigh Religious Network for Gay and Lesbian Equality, which we called Ringle. And I became the chair of it. I was the convener, and was the convener for about 4 years. But it was a small group of clergy from all around Raleigh, including Roman Catholic, Episcopal, Lutheran, United Church of Christ, United Methodist, and the rabbi at Temple Beth-Or. And so it was a very active group. We were very public in our challenge to what was religion-based bigotry, but we didn't use that phrase then.
But you also sponsored, I think, at least two or three conferences which I think had a really wonderful effect on our community. Enabled some people to come out.
Yes.
It's really great. Well, we've got to stop, folks. It's time to go to church.
Thanks again for having me.